Welcome to Creature Feature, production of iHeartRadio. I'm your host, a mini parasite's Katie Golden. I studied psychology and evolutionary biology, and today on the show, animals living secret lives. From secret societies to secret nighttime powers to secretly being a living animal in the first place, these critters are not letting you in their club unless you know the handshake. Discover this and more as we answer the age-old question, if you stab a rock, does it not bleed? Joining me today is one of my favorite science writers who has written amazing articles about all sorts of creatures for the New York Times, and she is currently working on a book for Atlas Obscura about some of the world's weirdest critters. Welcome, Kara Giammo. Welcome! I'm so excited to have you on. I'm a little starstruck because I often refer to your articles when I'm researching for the show, so it's both weird and really exciting to be talking to you in person on the show.
That's really flattering. I'm so glad that I've helped to inspire such a wacky and fun show with my writing.
Well, thank you so much. And speaking of which, I used some of your articles to help with the research and inspire this very episode, including one you wrote on giraffes. So in this first section, I want to talk about the secret social lives of mammals. These are secret mammalian societies because we often are very egocentric, very primate-centric, where we think, you know, yeah, primates are smart, gorillas, chimps, humans, elephants, and dolphins, sort of like this. Yeah, you're smart too. But then when we start to talk about other animals, we're like, well, they couldn't be that complicated. They can't have like friends like humans do. That doesn't make sense. They're just big, dumb, galumphing things like giraffes, which don't seem like they'd be very smart. They have this huge long neck and this itty bitty head perched on top of this impossibly long body. And it just doesn't seem like they'd be someone interested in forming social bonds. But in fact, they may have something like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So first, I just want to say that in my experience, a lot of the history of animal research is, and plant research, to be honest, and research into any living things is scientists starting from the point of view that, oh, this thing can't be all that smart or all that talented. And then realizing over the course of, you know, years or decades that, oh, actually, all these creatures can do all these incredible things that we didn't know about. And they are smart, whether it's smart socially or smart with their bodies or just smart being able to survive or in ways that we haven't even thought of yet. So that's a really cool part of looking into this area of research. But yeah, with giraffes, I wrote about this recently for the New York Times about sort of secret giraffe social lives. And yeah, it's true. They used to have this reputation of being really solitary, but more and more researchers are seeing that they have really complex family groups. It's sort of like a female-centric society where moms and kids and grandmothers and grandkids will hang out. They do things like they mourn their dead. It's really complex. It's really cool.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, my perception of giraffes, probably also based on sort of childhood stories about giraffes, is they're very aloof. They're nonchalant, just with their head in the clouds, kind of literally eating leaves up in the trees without much of a care in the world. But they seem to actually have these social bonds. And like you said, it seems to be sort of this matriarchal society. So female giraffes forming friendships, having an emotional reaction to the death of like a calf where they stand over it for many hours. They seem to sometimes even engage in alloparenting, which is when a non-parent will look after another giraffe's offspring. So they babysit each other's calves. And so this is something that is just recently sort of been observed. Researchers had to look at like their specific spot pattern to ID them because it's sort of like a thumbprint where when you have a spot pattern, you can tell one individual from the other. But because they're so, because they have that such a like a dolce vita kind of laid back slow lifestyle, it was, I guess, hard to tell that, yeah, they are in fact hanging out with each other and they do prefer the company of certain friends. It's just we didn't think like a giraffe and didn't observe them from the point of view of a giraffe. And so we never really caught that.
Yeah, totally. I think that's something that's also a little bit egocentric about us, is that when a creature doesn't live a lifestyle that's recognizable to us, we just sometimes kind of assume that it's not interesting or not worth studying. The researchers I talked to for this, yeah, pointed out that giraffes especially are quite slow and quite quiet. They don't have a lot of vocalizations. And so since humans are like really fast paced, and many of us in our lives, and we are constantly talking.
Constantly talking. I don't know anything about that. It's not like I do that for a living.
Imagine a giraffe studying us. They would be like, they can't possibly be doing anything meaningful. They're just chattering constantly. We don't know what they're saying, and so we don't care.
Yeah, how can they have time to think? They're spending all their time just like yammering on and on, making meat sounds with their little face flaps. It's very strange.
Making podcasts. Like, we can't handle this. But yeah, so You're right. Once they figured out how to distinguish individual giraffes by their spot patterns, which took a while, they started to see that there were these really strong connections. The daycare thing is so, the alloparenting is so impressive to me, because I know that it's quite hard for humans to get together and figure out childcare.
Yeah.
So the fact that giraffes can do this is pretty sweet. Maybe we should be looking even more carefully about how they pull this off.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's kind of a constant theme on the show, too. Whenever I tell a guest about a case of alloparenting, like, hey, look how bats and giraffes and, you know, all these animals will sort of help each other rear their offspring. They're like, that seems like a really good idea, especially parents who come on. They're like, hey, could we do that, too? Maybe that would be great.
Right. I'm not a parent, so I'm not going to claim to understand the struggle, but it is interesting to think of having someone say, yeah, I can't find a babysitter. And you just say to them, oh, well, have you thought of finding a bunch of bats that could maybe like vomit food into your child's mouth every once in a while?
And sounds good to me. I'm going to find a colony of vampire bats and be like, could you just vom a little bit of that nice blood into my baby's mouth when I'm not around? It's got a lot of iron, a lot of nutrients. Yeah. So there's this idea called the grandmother hypothesis, which is that in certain social animals, long-lived females can help their offspring and grand offspring survive. And so you'll see in some animals, especially like elephants, but you also see it in giraffes, where females will live long past their reproductive years. And so the idea is there is an advantage to this because they can actually offer help to the younger generations and ensure that their offspring and offspring's offspring actually survive. And this often will lead to more complex socialization, because you basically are able to retain more knowledge because you have an extra generation hanging around passing on wisdom and knowledge. And whether we don't know exactly yet like how this works in giraffes, I think even knowing that giraffes have this capability is relatively new. So who knows what hidden giraffe wisdom is getting passed on from giraffe to giraffe. Probably things like the best kinds of throat lozenge leaves to eat, because
yeah, imagine being a giraffe with a sore throat. You would definitely want to get your heads together with some other giraffes and figure out how to fix that.
And it's not just giraffes, I think, that are very surprising when you learn how socially intelligent they are. One of the cutest animals that looks sort of like an overgrown rodent and but doesn't seem like it has much going on in terms of intelligence are otters, which, you know, there are many different species of otters. I think the most famous is probably the sea otter, because they are just, they're the cutest otter. I mean, I love all otters. I try not to judge based on appearance, but I think it is pretty objective that sea otters are the cutest ones. It's just those little cheeks.
Yeah, sea otters are extremely cute. I actually, as a child at a summer camp, kidnapped a stuffed animal sea otter.
Wow.
Because I couldn't resist how cute he was, and I didn't want to think about him like in the winter with no one to snuggle him.
Yeah.
So I brought him home.
You kidnapped a stuffed
A real one.
Not a real one.
The animal one.
I think that's called shoplifting, actually.
Yes, I stole him from a camp toy bin.
I see, yeah.
So not technically a shop, but also probably not technically a good thing to do.
Otter napping. And the most adorable crime. Nothing. The most adorable crime I've ever heard. I'm not a narc. Don't worry. I won't turn you in to the otter police. But yeah, I mean, they are adorable. I think a lot of people are aware of this otter fact, which is that sea otters will use rudimentary tools to use in aiding them to crack open the shells of shellfish that they like to eat. So either it's a little rock they keep on their tummies that they just kind of use as their favorite little abalone shell smasher, or they also use available rocks in the water. So if there's a reef or a sort of rocky coastline, they'll smash their shellfish against those rocks as well. But that's not the only instance of otter cleverness. They also use kelp forests or even human constructions, both to kind of keep as a nursery for their offspring. So they just like kind of bundle their young up in some kelp or put them on a boat or something so that they don't float away, because that's a real concern. Aside from just their tool use and their clever use of their environment, you know, they also like hold hands, which is the cutest thing ever. But yeah, they'll grab their mate's hand because they don't want their mate to float away. Because their main form of resting in the ocean is just floating on their backs like little boats.
Yeah.
Fuzzy, cute little boats. But of course, they want to stay together with their mate. They'll link hands together so they can be two ships in an ocean of love. And it's adorable.
Yeah. All you have to do is you put your baby in a bunch of kelp.
Yep.
So it doesn't float away, and then you can hold hands with your mate and just float around. It
yeah.
seems ideal.
They do also carry their young like on their tummies, you know, just keeping them safe. But if they need to like get some food, like, you know, go hunting, there needs to be some way to keep the baby from floating away. They also use the kelp forest for themselves. They'll like tangle themselves up in the kelp so that they don't float away and while they're resting. So yeah, they have a keen sense of sort of naval protocol. But there's some kind of interesting observational evidence that seems to indicate that otter intelligence goes even deeper than what we may think. So sea otters are not really easily available for research. They're not in a lot of zoos. You know, it's not an animal that you can really sort of post up next to and observe for long periods of time. So it's a little difficult to research, but we have been able to do more studies on other species of otters that are more common in zoos, such as smooth-coated otters. So they are not sea otters, they're freshwater otters found in Southeast Asia and India. And they hunt cooperatively and will copy each other when presented with a novel problem, such as food stuck in Tupperware that must be opened. Mm. So when researchers present them with a Tupperware puzzle with some tasty food stuck inside Tupperware that either pulls open or unscrews open, they will learn from each other. So it might take them a while to figure out, but once one of them's figured it out, a lot of them will quickly get it because they've copied the one that finally figured it out. And the young otters are really fast at that. So the young are definitely quicker learners than the older otters, and they will copy their peers much more quickly to open up the Tupperware.
It's like young humans who are like, oh yeah, I know how to use TikTok. It's easy.
Yeah.
And then the older humans are like, I've never seen anything like this before.
Yeah.
A Tupperware?
A TikTok?
What?
A tac-toe?
It's not a shell? Yeah.
Now what's a tic-tac-toe? It's like, ugh. Yeah,
the older otters are like, this shell, it's like plasticky and like it doesn't crack, like I just don't even know how to deal with this.
Oh my gosh, mom, like, it's called Tupperware, get it together. I love,
you're so embarrassing.
Yeah, just imagine these young otters rolling their eyes, clickety clacking on their little shell phone TikToks, But there's, even though this study has not been done with sea otters, there is some anecdotal evidence that seems to indicate they are also much more intelligent than perhaps we give them credit for. So at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, an otter named Kit amuses herself by creating her own puzzles. So she has a plastic board with a number of holes in it that I guess is just sort of one of these like little enrichment toys. But she takes it a step further by putting a shrimp on top of it, diving underneath it, and trying to figure out how to grab the shrimp from underneath this board. But every time she ends up getting it, and it's kind of a game of reverse whack-a-mole because there are these little holes and she'll like put a paw up to try to grab the shrimp wherever it is. And when she gets it, instead of just eating the shrimp, she puts it back on top of the board and dives under to try again. So this is not just a feeding activity. This is her little game that she's set up for self-enrichment.
That's so cute. My cat does something like that. We like to play with twisty ties.
Yes.
I have two cats. They're sisters. And one of them, if you throw the twisty tie, it will just like chase it, get it. Like, then you throw it again, she chases it, gets it. But the other one, Poppy Seed, if you throw the twist tie, she'll go behind like four different chairs so that she has to jump through them in order to get it. She like makes it more complicated for herself. It's very cute.
She's got to up the challenge. Like, you know, when you...
She could be an otter, yeah.
I think there is something to that, because if you are a complex animal who's intelligent and you have food readily available to you, like I'm sure you feed your cats, you don't make them subsist in the wild on their own. And these otters in the zoo are fed and taken care of, but they still need that intellectual stimulation. So cats love to play. And this otter probably, in the absence of having to find her own food and figure out how to crack open her own food, which I'm sure the zoo probably also provides enrichment activities, but you know, it's a cushy life. And so she's got to introduce an element of fun and games into it.
Yeah, I think humans can definitely relate to that.
Yeah,
very strongly.
I think sometimes we're also sort of in denial about animal intelligence, especially when it makes us uncomfortable, such as the intelligence of farm animals and animals that we like to eat. And I'm definitely not coming from a high horse, because I personally am not a vegetarian. But I cannot deny that we do underestimate the intelligence of animals that we consume as food. And one such animal are cows. So cows may not be the smartest of barnyard animals. I think that probably goes to pigs. But that does not mean that they are mindless, grass-munching sort of empty vessels of meat. They have performed really well at memory tasks when it comes to locating quality food. They can quickly remember a good food location or landmark within a day and remember that association for up to 48 days, which I think might actually be better than my memory sometimes when it comes to sort of spatial navigation. And they also have a secret social life. They often have a preferred cow friend they like to hang out with and eat with. So a little more complicated than I think is always comfortable to think about, considering that we farm them.
Yeah, that's really, really good to remember. I think, again, like from my perspective, pretty much all animals have something like that, even that's legible to us, that we can see as intelligence if we just look carefully.
Yeah.
And then also on top of that, probably a lot of things that we just don't appreciate because we don't live their lives.
Yeah.
I want to plug, I have a poem that I really love about cows.
Yeah, go for
it. It's by Lydia Davis. It's just called The Cows, but it's about their movements and how they arrange themselves in space. And she makes it seem very intelligent and beautiful. Which it is, if you look at it the right way, I think. If you want to think a little deeper about cows, that poem is great.
And ironically excited about cow poetry now.
Great. I'll send you a copy.
Thank you. But yeah, and in fact, they have recently been found that they can be trained to use the toilet. So by rewarding cows with food for peeing in a special cow toilet, and then also spritzing them with a sprinkler when they go outside the toilet, which I don't think hurts them, but they don't like it. It's kind of like when you spray a cat with a spray bottle. They do not like that.
Right.
It's not appreciated. Researchers were able to toilet train the cows. So the cows were able to open and close the gate to the bathroom all by themselves, go do their business, and come right out. which
wow.
Yeah, I know. It's you kind of don't think of a cow as being capable of it. Our perception of them is they're big, dumb, messy, and without really, you know, much goals in life other than to eat grass and, you know, pass gas.
Yeah, I think that perception seems really new to me too, because if you think about all the older cultures and the you know, non-US cultures that like valorize cows, and also even like European like Renaissance paintings of cows, they're such beautiful, amazing, peaceful animals.
Yeah.
I think the factory farming system has kind of forced us to look at them in this particular way. But I'm glad that people are starting to research their abilities. And I think I saw a study last year where cows could use VR goggles or something like that.
I saw that too. Cows and VR.
Yeah, cows of the future.
Yeah, and I think that was like to see if they could improve cows' quality of life through VR, which is...
Right.
It's interesting, and I'm not against that kind of research, but it's also like, maybe we should just give cows a little more space outside.
Yeah, right. It's kind of spooky. Like, should we put cows in the matrix?
Yeah, so like that a we cow matrix.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about that. Actually, I think I would have to say that I don't like that.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about that either. Because then you're going to need like a Keanu Reeves to be Neo.
Oh, wow. And,
you know. Free all the cows from the cow matrix. I was waiting for it to land that one.
That was really good.
Thank you. But yeah, the hope for the cow toilet is that it will be more sanitary for the cows. It allowed them to keep their living areas clean, giving them some autonomy over their environment, as well as reducing ammonia emissions from their urine, which can be really bad when it sort of gets into the water cycle. It can like contribute to acid rain and runoff that can destroy sort of wetlands and coastal areas. So cow toilets actually could be a vast improvement for farms. But I think like that would still, it's just one piece of maybe completely revamping our factory farm system. Because, you know, even if you're not a vegetarian, which I'm personally not a vegetarian, but I'm still extremely uncomfortable with factory farming. I think that if we're going to eat animals, we should at least have the decency to give them a good life, not just sort of basic humane treatment, but actually good quality of life where they can go outside and have fun cow times.
Yeah, totally. I think that's another kind of upshot of the stuff we're talking about here. Like the more we learn about animals and how they like to enjoy life and all of the different things that they do with their days, like it's only logical and like, you know, moral that we should try to help them have lives like that, especially like you said, if we're going to eat them at the end of it. I feel like we kind of owe it to them.
Yeah, exactly.
I am a vegetarian, so I have a very small soapbox, but I also understand that people make different decisions about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think if you ask your average person, they would agree that they want the animals that they interact with to have good lives.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, and it's something that's would require some amount of sacrifice for our own just immediate wants. Like probably it would require our cutting our meat consumption because we simply cannot sustain sort of the massive magnitude of cows we keep in factory farm settings. But I think that in the long run, I think that kind of thing would also be much more beneficial to humans because I don't think factory farms are good for human workers. They put smaller farms out of business. They're not great on workers' rights and workers' safety. We saw that during the pandemic. And it's really bad for the environment as well. So I think that when we open our minds to maybe respecting animals we see as dumb or unimportant or expendable, we may actually kind of be able to introspect a little more about how, well, maybe we're viewing this as an inevitable thing, but if we change it, we may actually improve human life as well.
Yeah.
As well as sort of, I think, our moral imperative to make sure the animals that we have in our care are, you know, living good, comfortable, and enjoyable lives, even if we decide to use them as meat eventually.
Yeah, I think that's totally true and a really good point. Like, we're all connected, especially now, and humans make so many decisions that affect other species. it is really good to think about, to think them through in that way, and not just think about like the profit motive or whatever is like we're used to having at the top of our minds.
Yeah, exactly. One of my favorite kinds of animal secrets is when you don't even realize it's an animal or that it's even alive. So there are lots of animals that like to play dead, and we've talked about some of them on the show. We've talked about we've talked about possums a lot. I love possums, love their incredible playing dead trick. We've talked about hognose snakes. They also love to play dead. But I think sometimes it's like, it seems like a fairly complicated behavior that you would expect from something like, okay, yeah, a possum is pretty intelligent. Like, you know, even a hognose snake, it's like they've got a sizable brain and they can, you know, use this to their advantage to be able to fake out a predator. But you wrote a recent article about antlion larvae who will play dead, which to me is very interesting because it is, you know, when I think about insects, they're one of the more simple animals. No judgment. I love insects. But then you take that and you even take like their larva. It's like this very complicated behavior in such a simple little package.
Totally. I love insects. I write about insects a lot. And part of the reason why is because they're so surprising. Like you said, we have this image of them as simple and they are very small and their brains are often very small. But while people, I think, used to think of them as interesting study subjects because they thought of them as like automatons where they're programmed to do certain things and they have like a limited number of moves, you know, like a video game character or something. We're learning that they're actually much more complex and interesting than that. And that predator species like praying mantises are so complicated in the ways that they are able to catch bugs. And then meanwhile, prey species like antlions are actually really complicated in the ways that they avoid being eaten.
Yeah.
Yeah. With these antlion larvae, yeah, some of them can play dead for over an hour, which is very difficult to imagine. Like if you're in a, let's say like a zombie situation and you need to pretend to be dead, like none of us could do it for an hour. It would be way too hard. You got to breathe. You got
to. My nose would immediately be itching. Like if I had to play dead, it's like, oh God, but I have to itch my nose. I'd be dead in like 2 minutes because I'd have to itch my nose. Yeah. Like just thinking about having to itch my nose makes me want to itch my nose.
Yeah.
So
the antlion larvae would all survive the zombie invasion and we would not.
Wow. Well,
yeah.
You know, stick that in your pipe and smoke at humanity. Yeah. So, you know, I think this is something that it touches upon this greater theme of like, you see this animal, it doesn't look like much on the surface. Like an antlion larva, it looks sort of like a creepy little sort of fuzzy, spiky, almost like, I don't know, like living tiny pine cone. they don't, you know, they don't look like much. But then they have this incredibly complex behavior of playing dead. And then they bank on the fact that they sort of don't look like much to kind of be bypassed by some predator.
Yeah. This study was really cool because like even the researchers, you know, they didn't mean to find this out. They were trying to study something different. And they just had picked up a bunch of antlion larvae because they wanted to weigh them and they thought it was going to be really hard because they thought they'd be skittering around.
Yeah.
But as soon as they put them on the scale, the larvae were just like, we're dead. And the researchers were like, we didn't know you could do this.
Yeah.
And so they decided to sort of look into it and they found some really impressive time spans that they could do it for, as well as the fact that the time span really varies. So different larvae at different times will play dead for very, very different amounts of time because it's kind of a group survival strategy where like maybe like at least some will survive even if others can't do it for long enough.
Yeah. Yeah. And that almost makes me think it's similar to, you know, the kind of like gambling thing of if you are always consistently playing dead for a consistent amount of time, that behavior becomes easier to predict as a predator. Whereas if it's very variable, the predator can't figure it out, can't predict it. So it's like with slot machines or gambling. If you can predict how the slot machine works, you basically can win at the slot machine. But if you can't predict it, it will continue to trick you the whole time you're there and you'll lose all your money. Not speaking from experience. I do like how one of the researchers described it as cute, how they seem to demonstrate an abundance of caution when they're playing dead.
Yeah.
No, I'm dead. Don't worry about it for hours.
I love talking to researchers, especially insect researchers, because they have often such fondness for their subject.
Yes.
Like anybody does when they've worked with something for a long time. And they will call things cute that you would never think of. But
yeah.
when you do pay some attention, you're like, yeah, that is cute.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's, I think that is, to me, an important message to get across in this podcast is things that kind of look gooey or weird. It's like, yeah, but if you get to know them, they're charming.
Totally. Totally.
Sometimes animals don't even seem like they're alive. And it's not even that they're playing dead, but their physical appearance is not what you would expect to find in a living animal. And one example of this, which I think is, it's really funny, it's this recent discovery made in Japan, is a isopod that looks like a piece of sushi. Marine isopods are these creepy crawly arthropods that can either be small or really huge, like puppy sized. There are these tongue-eating louses, which we've talked about before on the show. They kind of look like overgrown roly-polies or pill bugs. I think it depends on which region you're in, what you call them, but like roly-polies, pill bugs. Maybe some people call them like potato bugs. I'm not really sure what all the different names are. But and the reason they look like giant pill bugs is that pill bugs are also isopods. So they're terrestrial isopods, while there are also marine isopods. Usually marine isopods are this pale, ghostly white. They're a little bit creepy looking, maybe, especially ones that peek out of a fish's mouth, just like, you know, like, haha, I'm eaten your tongue, which we actually talked about on the last episode. Off the coast of Japan's northern island, Hokkaido, one of these was found that was pink and beautiful, and it looked exactly like a piece of salmon sushi. It looks delicious.
Yeah, I'm looking at this picture now. If it were, you know, in a little tray, I would probably think it was a piece of sushi.
Yeah, in a tray with like some of that little like plastic grass. It looks delicious. It has that, you know, white banding across it, which is actually its segments, but it looks pink, and it's like, and the fact that its belly is white, it makes it look like it's a piece of salmon sitting on top of a ball of rice, which I think is what's so funny about this is clearly there's no advantage to this isopod looking like a piece of sushi. This is an example of complete coincidence where we see this thing and it looks like something entirely different, but it has not evolved to look like sushi.
It would be so funny if it had.
Like, right.
If it was an isopod who had evolved, like specifically in the context of like the Whole Foods prepared food section.
Right.
And it just like made its life there. But yeah, I see what you're saying.
It's like preying on humans somehow. We eat it and then it becomes an endoparasite inside us.
That's a really cool idea for a movie.
Yeah. Yeah. The secret sushi killers. The reason this one is this beautiful pink color and not its normal ghostly white pale color is thought to probably be its diet. So the aquarium caretakers think this unusual color is because whatever fish that this little guy was a parasite on may have had more pink coloration or red coloration. And so for some reason, this little guy was getting this from its diet. It could also potentially be a mutation. We know that with lobsters, there are a lot of color mutations, a change in the structure of the proteins in their exoskeleton that can turn them from bright blue to sort of an orange color, which, you know, lobsters are not orange. They do not look like cooked lobsters in nature. They look like they have this muddy brown coloration.
Right.
But yeah, it's... I just love that it's like, it is seafood, but not the kind of seafood you think it is.
Yeah, no, it's very fun to think about and look at. I encourage everybody to click through and look at this little guy.
Speaking of something that is seafood, but deceptive, is, just imagine you're in a fancy restaurant and a chef just drops this big gray craggly rock in front of you and, you know, kind of looks at you expectantly and you're just like, okay, thanks for the rock, I guess. Then the chef takes out a big butcher's knife, slices into the rock, and it reveals like this marbled flesh inside. You're not on an alien planet. You are on Earth, and you are lucky enough to try some meat rock known as Piura chilensis. So this is
extremely cool.
Yeah, it looks like a Photoshop or an alien, because it literally looks like a rock that you slice into, and there's a bunch of sort of reddish orange organs inside. And this thing is actually alive, and it is a tunicate, also known as a sea squirt, a much cuter name than tunicate. But we've actually talked about tunicates a little bit before on the show, how they start off life as a weird little tadpole creature, and then they attach themselves to a rock. And as an adult, they become completely sessile or immobile. And they will grow this sort of hard cellulose-like tunicate or tunate shell. It's not really a shell. It's like this. It's actually really weird because it is structurally very similar to plant cellulose, but it is obviously coming from an animal. And so for this meat rock tunicate, it is a little different from some of the marine tunicates we've talked about before, because a lot of tunicates are these really beautiful, bright, vibrant colors. They look almost like plants or like some kind of alien trumpet with bright purples and yellows. But Piura chilensis, it just looks like a big, gray, weird rock until you cut into it.
Yeah. It's really surprising to see the inside. It's really shocking.
Yeah, yeah. It looks completely alien or completely made up. Looks sort of like a Cronenberg creation from one of his movies. It's called Piura in Spanish, and it's commonly found off the coast of Chile. So they're often used in cuisine because those chunks of meat inside the quote unquote rock exterior are apparently quite tasty, both raw and cooked. Apparently, it tastes like a stronger sea urchin with a sort of cilantro soapy taste, which I'm not going to judge because I've never actually eaten it. But to me, soapy doesn't sound like something I'd want to eat. But, you know, if it is used enough, it must have some good flavor going on there.
It's just so funny to think about, like, it's such a human thing, apparently also an otter thing, to just, like, pick something up, crack it open, and be like, can I eat that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's
do it. Something we share with the otters. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there was a YouTube video of some guy, like, cutting into these things and, like, stabbing these things, and it was actually taken down for graphic content. Which I think is kind of funny, because there are all sorts of YouTube videos of people like gutting fish, and you know, it's like it's the same thing, but somehow meat rock was a little too far for YouTube standards.
Totally.
Yeah, like I mentioned earlier, like most tunicates, this meat rock starts off life as actually a mobile little tadpole thing that lives in the ocean, and then it'll attach itself to a rock. And in fact, like with a lot of tunicates, it goes through this metamorphosis where it actually depletes its brain size and increases its stomach capacity. And so it really kind of emphasizes the ability to suck food in through the siphon.
Like what people do on Thanksgiving, right?
They
decrease their brain so that they can
exactly.
eat more food.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Brain off, mouth open. That's my philosophy. That's my Thanksgiving philosophy. And this is this little guy's philosophy. And then it grows into this rock-like creature, and that hard exterior called a tunican, which, like I mentioned earlier, it's made out of a weird animal version of cellulose. And then underneath that layer of tunican is a sort of skin and then muscle and organs. So very strange. And also even weirder and more alien is its blood is actually clear and full of vanadium, which is a rare chemical element whose role in the tunicate's circulatory system is really unclear. We don't know why.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Huh. Cool.
Yeah. And I can't figure out the anatomy of it. I tried and I looked for diagrams, but it's like you cut into it and there's just all these like meaty chunks. And I'm assuming one of the chunks is like the pharynx, maybe the digestive tract. Probably one of them's the gonads, which mm-hmm. they're hermaphroditic. Which allows them to reproduce asexually or sexually, which is handy because if you're basically living your life as a immobile rock and you happen to right. pick a neighborhood that no other tunicates set up shop in, you're out of luck. Right. So you got to be like, well, right. it's just me and myself and it's, you know, gotta make babies somehow.
This is like a good challenge for me. As I said before, I really try to see the like cool, smart aspects of every creature. And the farther away you get from like the human lifestyle and body plan, the more of an exercise in imagination that can be. And this guy is just like, I have on faith to me in my heart. He is very smart.
Meat rock.
Talented.
Well,
yeah, but how? Like, what's his deal?
Well, he's
just being a meat rock is very impressive, but like, what else?
I mean, he or she,
hard to imagine, often
both, like he, this little thing, it's like, well, it's not always that little, actually. It can get to be kind of a sizable rock shape mm-hmm. sort of thingy. It seems to, like, it's one of these weird things where it kind of is Benjamin Buttons, because it starts out life with much more brain power, much more of a nervous system mm-hmm. that it sort of ends up at. So maybe that's mm-hmm. that was the good decision, was getting rid of its ability to think and
getting rid of the brain.
Yeah, investing brain. It all into the ability to like suck food in and filter it out and just live mm-hmm. good life as a little gray rock. Maybe that's the wisdom the whole time.
Yeah, good to learn from. That's a really good point.
So one of my favorite of the sort of articles that you write are on these mysterious glowing animals that keep popping up. And it is something that I've been following a little bit on the podcast. And it's just, it seems like every month or two, there's a new animal. They're like, this one glows too. So we're talking about biofluorescence in mammals. And there are a lot of animals that biofluoresce, like reptiles and arthropods and marine animals, but no, like seeing biofluorescence in mammals is, or it was and up until recently, very unexpected.
Can I just give a little breakdown of the yeah. differences between these kinds of things?
Yes.
Yeah. So there's a couple of different kinds of glowing when it comes to animals. So the one that we're talking about right now that has been observed in mammals recently, and then before that in amphibians and some reptiles, is UV fluorescence. So when you put these animals under a UV light or expose them to strong UV light, they have pigments or other chemicals or molecules in their fur or their, you know, carapaces or wherever that kind of transform the light that's being absorbed into a different color of light and emit it within the visible spectrum. So it's like if you are at like a blacklight party and you have a glow stick or you have like a white t-shirt, your white t-shirt is doing that same thing. It's like taking in light that's invisible to you and emitting it as like a really bright blue color that you can see. So that's what those animals are doing. And then a lot of the underwater glowing from marine creatures are much better at actually creating their own light.
Yeah, which is bioluminescence, not biofluorescence.
Yeah, totally. So there's two different kinds. We're talking about biofluorescence And some people argue that we shouldn't call it biofluorescence because it's not like a living property, it's like a material property. But I think it's okay, because they're talking about a material property in a living thing. But yeah, it's really wild.
I mean, so marine life, you're right, absolutely right. Like there's a lot of bioluminescence. So that's the kind of thing you see in anglerfish or zooplankton, diatoms sometimes, or even like things like foxfire fungus will bioluminesce. I think that's the active verb, bioluminesce. But
I think it is too.
That is where the glow is produced by a chemical reaction, and it is visible with the naked human eye typically. Biofluorescence, like you mentioned, is actually the animal's skin or fur or whatever, or it doesn't have to be an animal, it can even be minerals or plants absorbing UV light and then re-emitting it at a different wavelength. And we can only see that when we are basically pumping in UV light and then seeing it re-emitted in a longer wavelength than it was originally. And there are also actually, to even get more confusing, there are marine animals that fluoresce instead of bioluminesce. So sharks do not are not bioluminescent. They don't provide their own chemical reaction that makes them glow, but they do biofluoresce. So they will glow under UV light. And there's some debate about like what this does. Like, is shark are sharks using this as social communication. But even stranger is the fact that we're just finding more and more mammals who biofluoresce, which, you know, a reminder that is the UV light thing. So there is an ever-growing list. I'm just going to go through some of the ones that I have compiled. So one of the more recent ones is the spring hare, which you just wrote about in the New York Times, which has maybe one of the coolest patterns of biofluorescence because it seems to like be these orange and pink glowing swirls, like some kind of Alice in Wonderland creature.
It's like a Pokemon. I think they're really cool. That's my favorite one too. That's the most recent one that's been sort of like officially described. It's mostly one research group that's really digging into this right now, although even like people from zoos and people in their backyards are doing some like less rigorous experimentation with it or exploration with it. But the spring hare is amazing, and the patchiness of the pattern is really cool because, like, when you're talking about a material property, people who don't think that the question for a lot of people is like, does this fluorescence have any utility for the animal? Like, can the animals, does it help the animals see each other or actually like see each other less well or be seen by predators less well? Because you can imagine, like, if your fur is absorbing UV light and then emitting it at a different wavelength, like maybe you're actually hiding from a predator that can see UV light and would otherwise see this light reflected off of you. So it could be actually like a camouflage mechanism, but people really argue about whether or not that's true. And the thing about the spring hare having like a patchy pattern is that some of like the hair is not different in other ways, right? Like, why would some of the hairs be fluorescing and some of them not if it was
Yeah,
just the material property of the hair?
the HIR on
Yeah, the
the
fur. Yeah, the fur is all the same. And so if the pattern is different but the fur is otherwise the same, then maybe the pattern does have some sort of utility, or else like why would it be there? So that's really exciting to me. And different hairs, HARE, have different patterns
That is
as well,
really
which is kind of
cool.
cool.
Yeah, that is so cool. And it kind of makes me think of sort of the shark biofluorescence where they also have these different patterns. So some researchers are wondering if this is a social thing, like a way to identify different individuals, but it's hard to
Oh,
know
cool.
because we would first that they must be able to actually see it. And I think there's some evidence that shark eyes are able to see UV light, but I don't think we know. We don't necessarily know about the spring hare yet. Which, by the way, is an absolutely adorable animal. A spring
So
hare
cute.
is a large rodent that looks like you crossed a kangaroo with a mouse. And they They actually live in the southern tip of Africa. So they are not a marsupial, but they do kind of look like a marsupial. But what I mean, that's one of the weird things, though, about these glowing animals. And I don't know if this is just an artifact of the way the research is going. Like, are we testing this on more marsupials and monotremes or something? Because it seems like a lot of these animals that are biofluorescing are either monotremes, meaning like platypuses or echidnas, or are marsupials like wombats, Tasmanian devils, bilbies, possums, bandicoots. It's so strange.
I think I can answer at least part of that question. The flippant answer is that Australia is really weird. All the animals in Australia are really weird. I don't know what they're getting up to at any given time. But that's not my real answer, which is that the group that is studying this really rigorously thinks that the things that these animals have in common so far are that they are like crepuscular nocturnal. So they're right. Like active at night and in the evening and at dawn, which is like also a time when the light conditions are different, obviously, than during the day. And that they're not predators, like they're prey animals mostly, or at least they have predators. So that kind of also supports the idea that maybe they are using this to hide somehow. The Australia thing is because, so outside of that group that is doing like a little bit of more rigorous experimentation, there are places that have done just sort of like shine a black light all around in the museum and see what happens.
Yeah.
And one of those people, one of those groups was an Australian museum that did a lot of light shining on their like taxidermed bilbies and stuff and found a lot of glowing, but it hasn't been sort of rigorously verified. So there's like clues that maybe these Australian mammals all have this, but it hasn't really been shown yet. The ones that has been shown for more definitively are platypus, the flying squirrel, or at least some species of flying squirrel, some species of opossum,
yes,
and the spring hare. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this is so interesting. And it's one of those things where once you kind of open up that Pandora's box of shining black lights on mammals to see which one of them glows, it's like, well, we have to keep going until we've tested it on every animal. Because it could be like we may be seeing some pattern, but until we know which animals do this, it's like, well, it could be that we just haven't shown black lights on enough animals. And I feel like one of the difficulties is you can't just walk up to a nocturnal animal with a black light and be like, could you hold still while I see if you're glowing? Because they're not gonna react kindly to that. In fact, it seems like a lot of the tests are either done on already dead animals that have been taxidermied, or people just going out to the roads at night and shining a black light on roadkill, which I love it, but it's one of the more questionable activities you can be doing as a researcher. I feel like if a police officer stopped you and it's like, well, what are you doing? It's like, oh, well, I just, you know, I'm shining this black light on roadkill to see if, you know, some of them glow. Right.
You need a cover story.
You're getting arrested for that, bud.
Yeah, for sure. I like the spring hare study because I don't think they could do this with the platypus one, but for that one, they were able to go to a zoo and find some spring hares and, like, give them peanuts and take pictures of them. So you got all these really cute, like, little model poses of the very patchy, beautiful, glowing spring hares eating a peanut.
Yeah. Rather than these poor, mangled, roadkill, glowing animals that...
Totally.
It's a smushed platypus that glows a beautiful color. But just to kind of give everyone a sense of the magnitude of how many of these animals have shown some signs of biofluorescence and what they look like, here's a probably incomplete list I've compiled of who's glowing and what they kind of look like. So sort of bluish green glow all over their bodies. It seems like platypus and wombat, maybe weakly. Bright white glowing spines seems to happen with echidnas. Tasmanian devils, which are interesting because they are... Now, they may have some predators, but they're mostly the predator themselves. And they... get into conflicts with each other, but not as much with other animals. But they do seem to have some biofluorescence, especially around their faces. Which kind of, it's like they have like blue highlighted features. Flying squirrels tend to have glowing underbellies. So there are a few species of flying squirrels that seem to biofluoresce, and they have this like pink glowing underbelly, which is adorable. Greater bilbies seem to have glowing white ears. And then ghost bats, very appropriately named, seem to have glowing yellow wings. Again, just to reiterate, this is all under UV light, so we can't see this with the naked eye. Striped possum may have some sort of highlighter pink glowing abilities. And Krefft's gliders, which are sort of like a sugar glider or flying squirrel in appearance, seem to have glowing blue bellies, which I think is interesting because you have the flying squirrels, which have glowing pink bellies, and then another glider and its belly glows blue. And then these, I saw some indication that they do glow, but I couldn't find like what color they glow. But long-nosed bandicoots, antechinus, and tree kangaroos, maybe. With a big maybe. There's like a really old observation of tree kangaroos. I don't think they've like replicated that, partially because tree kangaroos are very, very, very rare. And I think, like, weren't they recently like thought to have been, they were thought to have been very completely extinct, and then like recently they kind of found some wild population? Or am I getting that confused with another animal?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not up on my tree kangaroos, but I hope they're okay.
You're not up to date on your tree kangaroo trivia.
No.
Yeah, no, there are certain species of tree kangaroos which were thought to have been extinct up until 2018, and that was the Wandawoy tree kangaroo. So, yeah, it's they're elusive, so we don't know. We don't know their glowing secrets. But, yeah, it's just it's wild to me how there are so many animals that's like, you know, we've never tried shining a black. We've never taken these animals to a rave in their lives. And so we don't know if they glow like someone at Coachella under a black light. So yeah.
There's really only one solution, which is to do like a sort of Noah's Ark style rave.
Where we
one pair of every species in the same place and we just go for it.
Exactly. And everybody gets like a wristband. Yeah. The most exclusive rave in the world, the Noah's Ark rave. I love that. But yeah, it is really curious, and as far as I know, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Kara, but we still don't know exactly why they glow like this. The answer has yet to been definitively proven or even thoroughly studied.
Yeah, nobody really knows, and a lot of people argue that there couldn't possibly be a reason. It's actually, it's one of my favorite types of scientific question, which is the like really esoteric one that still inspires ferocious, angry debate.
Yes. I love it when biologists get mad.
I know. It's really fun. People have, often the people who, you know, discover this have maybe a bit of a vested interest in it being, having some sort of use. Although, of course, they're also rigorous scientists and they want to prove it for sure. So often I'll talk to the authors of the papers and they'll have a bunch of theories, and then I'll talk to somebody outside and they'll say like, no way, you know, or like we have to do so much more work to even get close to that. But people have come up with some really good theories.
What are some of those theories that you've heard without, you know, this is clearly, we don't know yet whether any of these are true without further study.
Totally. So one of the ones is what I mentioned before, in terms of hiding from predators through camouflage. So making themselves actually sort of counterintuitively less visible. Because obviously, like, if you saw a platypus, even in the moonlight, you wouldn't see it glowing. It would just look like a normal platypus unless you happened to have a black light, because as you mentioned, you were a freaky researcher looking for roadkill with a black light. So I think one of the kind of confusing things that you have to remember when you're reading studies like this is like the pictures that we show to like demonstrate the phenomenon. That's not what you would see in real life without a black light.
No.
It's not what another platypus would see. So you kind of have to like move one step beyond that and think about, okay, so what would another platypus see, or what would a platypus predator see? And a lot of predators, can see UV light much better than people can. And so it's possible that a platypus that would normally be reflecting this UV light so that it was visible is instead absorbing it
right.
and transmitting a different frequency. So the predator actually maybe can see it a little bit worse. So that's one possibility.
It's sort of like the wearing the black turtleneck in a heist movie, because black will mm-hmm. absorb light. And so, you know, when you try to shine a light off of a black turtleneck, the museum guards don't see and you can steal the Hope Diamond.
And you can shine a black light on all the specimens in the downstairs rooms. Yeah.
Right.
Or steal the Hope Diamond, or both, if you're having like a really good
dive. And because these animals are often crepuscular or nocturnal, you're not getting a huge amount of like UV light at night at all.
Right.
So that makes it more mysterious, where it's, you know, they're not absorbing huge amounts of UV light. We can only see it because we sort of pump them with this like little mini UV light ray that makes them, you know, leak out all of these longer wavelengths of visible light that we can see after we are just like pumping them chock full of UV light.
Yeah. Another theory is that, like, as we know, UV light can be kind of harmful to
yes.
cells. And so some people think that maybe by sort of taking it in and transforming it, the fur is protecting like the vulnerable skin from being exposed to UV, almost like sunscreen.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
I would love some cool. kind of like sunscreen that also biofluoresces, so I can like during
That's
the day
a good idea.
Protect my redhead, protect like my redhead skin from the sun, and then at night go to rave and it's like party all night,
yeah.
not
yeah.
get skin cancer during the day.
One of the coolest examples that I've seen lately, I wrote this up like last month for the New York Times, was there's these species of paper wasps in
Oh, I saw your article on that. I'm excited.
Yeah, it's cool. It's mostly the like coolest ones are in Vietnam, but they're found in other places as well. And the larvae of these wasps, you know, spin their own cocoons out of silk and kind of stay in there while they're metamorphosizing. Metamorphizing. And they found that, again, by accident, because of their UV lights, found that the silk of the cocoon is really, really strongly UV fluorescent, like way stronger than anything yet discovered in nature.
It's like this bright green. It looks like, I mean, it almost looks brighter than a glow stick to me.
Yeah, it's super bright. It's almost like a tree was growing like a tennis ball. You're like,
whoa. Yeah.
yeah, it's really cool. And one of the researchers said to me that his theory, and again, like this really requires further testing, is that when the larvae are metamorphizing into wasps, they need, you know, photoperiod signals. They need to know how long the days are because that helps them figure out like when it's time to do certain things. So they need to have access to the light conditions of the forest, but they maybe want to be protected from UV. So by having these little glowing, you know, not glowing, but biofluorescent cocoon caps, maybe it's like keeping the UV out while still letting the light inside. So almost like you have, like, I don't know, like a little LED in your room that like tells you when it's light out without
yeah.
exposing you to the light. Like maybe you're a vampire or something and you need to know
yeah.
when it's daytime and when it's not, but you don't want to be exposed to the light.
Having,
so it's
having
like
windows treated with some kind of like UV protection, like you get on sunglasses.
Totally. Yeah, exactly. And
That's
so to
so
us,
cool.
it looks really fluorescent, but to them, it's like a protective but information giving thing.
Yeah.
Which is really cool.
Which I think is, it's like another one of these things of we can't be so like, you know, anthropocentric or anthropocentric, where
yeah.
we think in terms of like, well, they're glowing to us when we flash the
right.
the black light on it. So it must have something to do with the glowing nature of this that gives them an advantage, but could be completely unrelated to the fact that they biofluoresce. It could have to do with like the way they absorb the UV light. It could be thermoregulation, which is sometimes the case with like these snakes that have this iridescence to their scales. It's beautiful. And so you think, well, is this like some kind of mate selection because it's so beautiful? Well, no, they don't care. It's probably more to do with the fact that structurally these scales are made so that they can absorb heat better, such that they can thermoregulate, so not getting too cold and not getting too hot. So the fact that they look
right.
like magical fairy princess snakes is just incidental But it's the right. It's the thermoregulation that's important. So something similar could be going on with these UV patterns, where it could either be that it's helping them, you know, absorb UV rays either for their benefit or to protect them from the harm, or, you know, for some kind of thermoregulation, or it could be completely incidental. So it could be that the structure of the proteins in the fur that like are biofluorescing just happen to biofluoresce, but they are structured in such a way that makes the fur like more protective for the animal or healthier. And in evolutionary biology, this is typically referred to like as an evolutionary spandrel. So it's when something happens in evolution, like there's some structure or some trait and it is incidental. So it's a byproduct of other structures that are necessary for an animal's evolutionary survival. And I think it comes from architecture, which I know a great deal less about, but I think it's basically when you have an archway, you have like these places where the arch meets the wall. And so it's like this chunk of basically unused space. So architects would often like decorate these spandrels with designs. And then people would sometimes wonder like, what is the structural purpose of this? And it's like, well, there's no structural purpose. It's just there because right. It has to be there because of the way the arch meets the wall. And so you might as well decorate it as an architect. So
I like that. That's
yeah.
Cool.
So before we go, we have to answer the question from last week of guess who's talking. So every week I play a mystery animal sound and you, the listener, and you, the guest, try to guess, hey, who's talking? Who the heck is that? And just as a reminder, last week's hint is that its name sounds like a collaboration between a biologist, a heavy metal band, and a hairdresser. Kind of sounds like a mandrake or a scary baby.
It's actually, yeah, I think I know exactly what it is. It's my cat, Peppercorn, when she wants to go outside.
How did you know?
How did you get into my house to record Peppercorn? Yeah.
Well, do you have any guesses other than Peppercorn?
Okay, so you said a biologist, a metal band, and a hairdresser?
Got together to name this thing.
So it's probably like a bird with something weird on its head. but
that's usually the answer.
The screaming mohawk parakeet is my guess.
God, you're so close. You're a little bit off
really?
By like the phylum and actual animal, but in terms of the actual name, you're very close.
Yeah.
So this is actually the screaming hairy armadillo.
Oh, what? It's an armadillo?
It's an armadillo. So this is found in South America, and it is indeed an armadillo. It is indeed hairy, and it does, in fact, scream, as you just heard. If you pick one up, they start shrieking. Wow. And it is thought that this is sort of the, like, car alarm effect. Because they're not really that social, so this is not thought to be a warning call to other individuals in its species, but it's thought to either startle predators when they pick them up or to make a predator afraid that an even bigger predator is going to approach, which I think is a really interesting gambit we've seen in a few prey animals where they will just make a huge commotion. And then that freaks out the predator that's like, well, okay, I was trying to go in this sneakily, but if you're screaming, like something bigger might come and actually eat me while I'm trying to eat you. So I think it'd work on me because it sounds like a demon baby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I would definitely put it down if it did that.
All right, and now on to this week's mystery animal sound. Here's a hint, not so fast. This isn't who you think it is. Kara, do you have any guesses? This is a very sneaky and tricky one.
So it sounds like that, despite how it sounds, it is not an adorable small bird who will help me get dressed for the ball. So no, I don't. I have no idea.
I've been extremely sneaky with this one. I almost feel a little mean about it, but I still will keep my lips tightly sealed until next week when we reveal the answer. And if you out there, listeners, think you know what this is, you can write to me at creaturefeaturepod@gmail.com, creaturefeaturepod on Instagram, or creaturefeetpod on Twitter. That's F-E-A-T, not F-E-E-T. That is something very different. But Kara, thank you so much for joining me today and for giving all your wisdom and insight that usually I would have to go and read your articles to get.
Yeah, this is in some ways more efficient, in some ways probably a lot less efficient, but I really appreciate being invited on, and I had a great time.
Well, where can people find all your awesome articles, and where can people find you online?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter at CJGIMO, that's CJGIAIMO, and then I write pretty frequently for the New York Times, and I'm working on this book for Atlas Obscura that won't be out for a while, but when it is, I will tell you where you can get it.
I am excited for that. And of course, I just told you where you can find the podcast online. You can find me online at Katie Golden on Twitter. I don't always tweet about animals, but when I do, they're really weird. Thank you so much for listening. If you're enjoying the show and you leave a rating and review, I will just be grateful forever and ever. I'll never forget it. I actually do read all the reviews, and I really appreciate all of them. And thank you so much to the Space Cossacks for their super awesome song, Exolumina. Creature Feature is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts like the one you just heard, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or hey, guess what? I don't care where you listen to your favorite shows. You can do it from inside a meat rock. See if I care. I don't judge you. See you next Wednesday.